The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Toni Morrison, in all of our education, whether it's in institutions or not, in homes or streets or whatever, whether it's scholarly or whether it's experiential, there's a kind of progression. We move from data to information to knowledge to wisdom. And separating one from the other, being able to distinguish among and between them, that is knowing the limitations and the danger of exercising one without the others, while respecting each category of intelligence, is generally what serious education is about. And if we agree that purposeful progression exists, then you'll see that it's easy, it's seductive to assume that data is really knowledge, or that information is indeed wisdom, or that knowledge can exist without data, and how easy and how effortlessly one can parade and disguise itself as another. And how quickly we can forget that wisdom without knowledge, wisdom without any data, is just a hunch. So, Dharma practice begins by collecting data, a lot of data, to know ourselves as a sensory system, to know life as experience, to know life as a Nietzsche. And the philosopher Thomas Nagel, now very famous essay, an attempt to define conscious experience. What is conscious experience? It's like, seems obvious, but very contested terrain philosophically. And even in our Buddhist tradition, a lot of different takes on what that even means. So Nagel says, an organism has conscious mental states if and only if there is something that it is to be that organism, something it is like for the organism, something that it is like. Well, what is it like? That's data. That's the Dharma. What is it like? Right now, it's like this, Ajahn Sumedho famously said, right? Right now, it's like this. What is it actually like? We try to put down some of the ideas about what it is, what it should be, beginner's mind. We're too insistent on what it is to be human. We've sort of been entranced by habits of perception and cultural mores about what it is. And maybe we can say, following Morrison, that we keep prematurely turning data into information, knowledge. We keep imposing and reiterating our framework, and we don't exactly learn. We keep reiterating our self. We don't exactly learn. We keep assuming, there I am, I come next, I come next. The familiar baseline self comes next. when I started meditating, I was, genuinely kind of startled by my mind. The data was sort of shocking. Not what I was, if you had asked me, Matthew, could you just go sit down for 60 minutes and just follow your breath? I think I might have said yes. I think I actually might have said yes. The data was shocking, and it was like, oh my God, the state of New York gave me a license to operate a motor vehicle. I really fooled them. And okay, there's data. We collect data. This is what it feels like to breathe. This is what it is like to try to anchor attention one place. This is what clinging feels like. This is peace. This is the pervasiveness of change. What is it like to sense change? We start to notice themes. The data emerges into information, to knowledge, patterns. The novel Candy House, Jennifer Egan. When a character says knowing everything is too much, like knowing nothing. Without a story, it's all just information. We start to assemble the data and information into patterns and observations to understand causality. The Buddha said to understand, to know the dharmas, to know causality. In other words, we start telling stories. Pattern is a certain kind of story. But our stories, the stories we tell, are much better than the stories we used to tell. They are richer. Our stories are less brittle. Dharma stories are not brittle. Brittle stories hold a lot of egoic, energy in place. Brittle stories cannot be challenged by another person, another view, because they hold a ton of feeling in place. They're charged with egoic investment. This is what's so. And for a long time, our stories can aid and abet our habits of avoidance, of delusion. And part of this movement from data to information to knowledge, part of the evolution of our stories, the capacity to speak about our inner life, about joy and sorrow and hope and fear and shame, all of it, to be able to speak about all of that fluently. Fluidly. The fluid stories can bend to include the views of others. They, our stories live alongside the permanent possibility of being wrong. They're nuanced, they're not fundamentalist stories. Brittle stories have a kind of defensive function. Dharma stories conduce towards silence. It's not that we elevate silence over story, but Dharma stories move towards silence. And they privilege the patterns we notice, the information that we gather, the knowledge we begin to weave, privileges the most fundamental distinction, suffering and non-suffering, suffering and peace. Ordinarily, our stories are all about self and other, praise and blame. good and evil, and now all of those distinctions bow to the much more useful investigation pattern about suffering and its causes. And the Buddha said, like, just as a lion rules over the wild, wisdom rules over all other spiritual faculties. Wisdom, okay, this movement from knowledge to wisdom, wisdom as realization. Wisdom is typically defined as realizing the Four Noble Truths, that there's suffering, there's a cause, there's an end, there's a path leading to the end of suffering. And so wisdom, in other words, has primarily been tied to explanation, explaining how suffering arises and ceases. Explanation. But there's a capacity related to explanation. It's not identical to it, but I associate it even more closely with wisdom, which is, rather than explanation, prediction. No matter what your worldview, no matter how wild or different it is, if you can predict something, I'm very interested. That's very compelling. And wisdom is the capacity to predict deep happiness, not mere pleasure, not merely for self, but for others too. Timothy Wilson, psychologist, says many cultures have myths in which people can make their dreams, their wishes come true. Common to these myths is the notion that if people could make their wishes come true, they'd achieve everlasting happiness. Sometimes, however, people are disappointed by the very things they think they want. Research on affective forecasting has shown that people routinely mispredict how much pleasure and displeasure future events will bring. As a result, sometimes work to bring about events that do not maximize their happiness. They go on to conclude, finding ways to increase the accuracy of affective emotional forecasts is a worthy enterprise, though not, we suspect, a particularly easy one. Can we predict what is truly good for our hearts? Can we see at depth what would make others happy, what would help them thrive? Can we observe within families or groups or organizations and discern what might be helpful, what might lead to the alleviation of suffering, the promotion of flourishing? This is the province of wisdom. And because we understand dukkha, the unquenchability, and because we understand the architecture of our nervous system, because we've collected so much data, because we understand the homelessness of ego, we can make better predictions about the future. And this helps us get more of what we want, truly want, and give others more of what they need. offer this for your consideration. Okay, may we live well today. See you tomorrow.